You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Welcome back to the show. Gary Gulman today, a genuine comics comic, a comedian's comedian in the truest sense. He is someone who I have an enormous amount of respect for, and not only is his art vivid and real and resonant and meaningful, as well as light and silly and funny and daft, not only all of that, but he is extraordinarily generous. You might be familiar online with Gary Gulman's writing tips. If you search that phrase into your chosen search engine, you will almost certainly find some sort of aggregation, or look in the Comedian's Comedian Facebook group. I think someone posted a link there. For some time, Gary was tweeting out one tweet a day with another writing tip on it. So, and they're really real. Listen, if you're listening to this podcast, you know, to the Comedian's Comedian podcast, let alone this episode, because you are particularly wanting to improve your writing, it's not all craft. It started off 8 years ago being all craft and then became craft and mental health and meaning and all those other things. But if you are one of the people who has always looked to this podcast for genuine craft, what would be the word? it'll turn out to be something like vocabulary or articulate, something I've failed spectacularly to do. But listen, if you're a writer of comedy or of anything, then this is the guy for you. He's just, and such a warm presence as well. It's all about giving everything away. So myself and Gary are going to discuss Gary's stand-up special slash documentary, The Great Depression, and the mental health journey which it charts via electroconvulsive therapy, ECT. I didn't know anyone did that anymore. And the use of medical ketamine through his recovery back to being on top of the world, creatively speaking. We learn the origin of the world's most humble opening joke and why we should give crowds credit for their vocabulary. We'll also talk about Kurt Vonnegut and the secret writing tip that's visible if you freeze frame a single shot of the movie. And let's not forget, there are 45 minutes of wonderful extra content available exclusively to members of the Insiders Club, including Gary on his extensive writing tips and why it's impossible to use up creativity, and some behind-the-scenes stuff on his experiences doing spots on Conan. That is all available to you if you're an insider. Go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for that, plus all the extra material from every episode that has it, which is getting on for an awful lot of episodes indeed. This, without further ado, is Gary Gulman. I think what I'll do is, in the setup to the show, in the kind of the intro, I will explain to our British viewers a little bit more about who you are, because I could, one of my options as an interviewer is to kind of lay on thick your accolades and so on at the beginning to introduce you to new audiences. I don't think you're that well known in the UK.
No.
Have you been here?
No.
Have you traveled here?
I mean, I've been there, but I've never performed there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I will set all of that up so we needn't retread it now. But I'm thrilled that you've listened to the podcast before. And I think there is, the more I kind of prepared for this interview, the more I found these little charming, there's one or two notes I kind of made on aspects of your work where I had the arrogance to think, we're not so different, you and I. Every time I found a little stylistic trick or a particular a type of self-deprecation. I was like, oh, I do that too. And it like, and instead of with some comics, I'd feel like, oh, I want to be my own guy. I'm so thrilled to feel like I'm in step with you.
That's so nice.
I will try and ask some difficult, penetrating questions as well, rather than simply fanning you for a while.
Sounds good.
So let's start with this. At the beginning of The Great Depression, which is your most recent special, which is more than a special, it's a documentary about you returning to stand-up after being hospitalised with clinical depression.
Yes.
Your opening line for that special is one of the most disarming I've ever heard. It's quickly become a favourite opening line of mine. You walk out on stage and you simply say to the audience, "You came." And the way that that sets the tone for you and for the hour is extraordinary. It's like the polar opposite of something equally very funny line. What it put me in mind of was an absolute opposite of Daniel Tosh's line, where he walks on to tremendous applause and says, "Believe it or not, that gets old." You know, it's like, it couldn't be more different. They're like the extremes of how to relate to an audience. So talk to me about, let's begin with that line and then kind of broaden it into what you do.
You are the first person to notice that line, and there's an enormous backstory to it.
Ah, wonderful.
Wow. So are you familiar with the actor, comedian, personality, Chris Elliott?
I'm actually not. I don't think so. No, okay, but I'm not good with names.
Okay,
so I might
so he was, he's on Schitt's Creek as the mayor. I don't know if you've ever watched that.
I have had it recommended, but
okay,
not watched
yeah.
it. Okay,
yeah, and so he was a regular writer and performer on the David Letterman show, and in 1990 and 91, he had a TV series in America called Get a Life, and Get a Life was this very influential show, and a lot of my favorite comedians, and I remember Judd Apatow saying it was one of the two shows, along with The Simpsons, that he had written a spec script for when he first got into writing scripts. So there was an mm-hmm. episode where Chris is – his job on the show is he's a 30-year-old paperboy who lives at home with his parents, but he's incredibly arrogant and pompous and just very, very outgoing and proud. Anyhow, he decides he's going to rehabilitate a gang, and he invites them to his parents' house to rehabilitate them. Meanwhile, he has no experience or training, and when they all show up and they're clearly to rob him and beat him up, he says, "You came," and he's so excited, and so. I started out one show in Los Angeles at Largo with that line, because my director, who I collaborated on extensively in a way that I'd never done with a director. I mean, he listened to all my sets and went to see me, and we worked out the timing of the jokes and the setup of the arc of the narrative so that it would play right with the documentary footage. So we worked on that together to make it a piece. And he said, "You should open the special by saying you came." He said he knew Chris Elliott. He knew that line. He said, "It's hilarious." I said, "But it comes from Get a Life." He said, "If I can get in touch with Chris Elliott and he says it's okay, will you do it?" And I said, I said, yes, thinking at the very least we would get in touch with Chris Elliott. So Mike, who is the director, directed David Letterman's Netflix show. So he had an in with Letterman. He got in touch with Chris. Chris responded, did not remember saying that line, and said, "By all means." Now, within a few months of sending that email and finishing the special, we embarked on a friendship with Chris Elliott that involved us going to visit him in Maine and staying overnight with our hero. I mean, that was the thing that that Mike, the director, and I bonded over was our obsession with with Chris Elliott and that show. So it was just remarkable how that worked out. And we became like close friends with Chris, and he came to the premiere, and he is someone that we worked on a project together. And so it was just so from the very beginning that special was just blessed with all kinds of ideal circumstances and gifts and good fortune. It was really something I've never experienced before. From the time Mike and I met to discuss the project, we decided, or he decided in the room. I knew that he was somebody I wanted to work with. He said, "Yeah, let's do this," in the room, which you know, in show business never happens. You usually wait until you hear nothing. And so that was really something. And from that first weekend, he started coming out to my shows and taking notes and listening. And we crafted this, it started off as about a half hour of material on depression. And by the end, I had an hour and a half. We had to cut it down to an hour. And it was just, it was smooth sailing from the very, very beginning. It was
what an incredible project. And it's such a brilliant piece of work. And it's so beautifully kind of counterpoints the, or not even counterpoints, but it kind of collages so many aspects of your life, the positive qualities of your life, the qualities of your art that you have kind of wrestled back from your depression and the effect that it's had on you.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because rarely, or maybe it happens frequently, I don't know, but I was particularly excited about the fact that working on this project and talking about it, I think, was a major component in my recovery. I think opening up about it and making it less severe and upsetting and getting the feedback and sort of redeeming this period of my life that was just miserable and scary in that way, I think was certainly a boost to my recovery, and I think made it even more stable. There were a lot of things that went on, and one of them, and I know a lot of people come to this earlier in life, but just accepting who I was in many ways that I had either been ashamed of or tried to keep from people, just the fact that I was a big person who was not really a dominant personality or somebody who was aggressive. I found that to be really liberating in being able to talk about that. And it seems like the talking about just the treatments, especially the electroconvulsive therapy treatment, once I let the air get at that or allowed people in on that, I found that I wasn't some freak who had this bizarre treatment that other people had had it. Other people had had good experiences, and other people were reluctant to try it and were more likely to try it based on my description and the effect it had on me. So all around I wonder how common it is that the art project you work on is part of your salvation. I'm sure it's not as direct as this, but in a lot of cases, I think people are saved by their art. So it's not that unusual. It's just, it was the first time it was so dramatic for me. And so I'm very, very, I feel very grateful and very, very fortunate because it wasn't something that was new. I'd suffered with depression for a long time, but being open about it and making it funny was something new, and it was very effective.
And you were very well placed to do that. It's almost like, although you didn't, I mean, there are comics starting now. There are comics, I'm sure, have started in the last few years who are aware of their depression, and it's the base or the basis of their work, the platform of, you know, it's the angle with which they attack
the whole job of becoming a comic. But you were in a position of having produced really, really strong comedy from a huge variety of topics before you'd started to tackle something so serious and something that you might think is so hard to make funny. Certainly when you talk about electroconvulsive therapy, which in 300 plus episodes has never been said out loud on this show before, or I know the bit where you talk about kind of being dosed with ketamine in hospital.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
these are very sort of extreme and scary sounding tools to help someone recover. These are big clinical tools. And the idea of being able to make them funny and also to talk about them sort of, what do I mean? Not just to make them funny, but also to make them fitting in a very rich expression of your comedy. Do you know what I mean? You've done your training. You've done all of the years at the Heavy Bag learning how to make anything funny.
Yeah.
And then we're able to apply that.
Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that up because I have tried to get that across, how much the timing was crucial, because I had a few things that the young comedians don't have. And one of them was a place in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's now in Somerville, Massachusetts, which is just a few miles apart, but it was a club, and you see it at the very beginning of the special. It was called it's called the Comedy Studio. And I had established myself there when I was living in Boston coming up. And so the owner, this man named Rick Jenkins, who's just incredibly nurturing and generous to comedians of all experiences, from beginners to veterans. And he allowed me to go on at the end of every show they had for that summer, and whatever time they had left, I was able to do, and there was no pressure to kill. If I went up there and bombed, he didn't say, well, tomorrow night, can you try to do better? He just allowed me to fail. And I was careful that I always ended well. I had some things that would work, and I would go to them so that the people didn't feel that they had just listened to a therapy session. But sure. I pretty much was able to do that. So I had that was one ace in my up my sleeve. The other thing was that when I had sort of a critical mass of depression material and hospital material, I was able to go on the road and do hour and a half, 2 hour shows in front of an audience that I had cultivated over the years, that I could pretty much sell 200 tickets anywhere and in the US, and some places 1,000 or 2,000, a handful of places I could sell 1,000 or 2,000 and sell out a weekend or do a big theater in Boston or New York. But I had this audience who trusted me, who had seen all my stuff and trusted that I would be funny. So it wasn't like when we go to a comedy club where they don't even know who's performing and you go on there. For instance, I was able to work out a few things at the Comedy Cellar, but I had to establish my credentials early on, do well, and then I could pivot and do some stuff. I would say, who here has ever been recognized in the psych ward? And if they if they reacted well to that, then I would do a few depression jokes. But I only had 15 or 20 minutes, in some cases 10 minutes, at the Comedy Cellar and the other spots in the city. So it was crucial that I was able to work these jokes out in long form over an hour and a half or more on the road. So I had that audience, and I just don't know how a comedian could start out and immediately go into depression stuff. That is really brave. I had a very warm and receptive audience nearly from the get-go, and then because I do meet and greets, I was getting not just the laughs but also the feedback afterwards, where people would say that really resonated with me. I was in the hospital, I had electroconvulsive therapy, or I've been struggling with depression, and that meant so much to me to hear somebody explain it. So, or just to let me know that I'm not alone. So I had so much positive feedback and so much encouragement that the bravery was overstated. I think a lot of people said that was so brave. I just got such excellent rewards and rewards that I wasn't used to, and that people would come up to me after the show. That was great show. You're so funny. But I didn't connect like that when you make yourself vulnerable, when you open up and discuss things that you thought should be kept secret. People are incredibly receptive and appreciative and grateful, and that's something that I held dear and actually kept me healthy, because I think there was the possibility early on in my recovery it was wobbly, and if I had had some setbacks, even just sometimes I think it all could have been undone if one day I dropped my phone in the toilet. Just something something could have gone way off the rails, and I would have been set back. And maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit, but I know that I had a really good run of positive things happening, and I had this project to work on as I emerged from the depression. My manager was very patient in that he gave me so much leeway as far as I didn't work for months, and I didn't have any projects. And when he saw what I was doing early on and talking about depression, he said, this is your next special. Let's work on that. I'd like you to meet with this director. And he was very patient, and but also was what's the word? He pushed me, but he wasn't,
yeah,
he was encouraging, and he wasn't demanding or in any way rushing me. He was very understanding of my condition, and his name is Brian Stern. And I just think he's the first manager I've had who has contributed in a major creative way, in that when he first saw me doing material about depression, he said, why don't we only have 20 minutes or a half hour. Why don't we split the hour into documentary and stand up and do some interviews. And we worked on that. And then as I got more and more comfortable talking about depression and anxiety and hospitalization, I was able to expand on that. And we only wound up having to use about 15 minutes of documentary footage and interviews, and I think that was a good balance, because the director Mike Bonfiglio, he told me early on, he said, I don't mean to put you down in any way, but you're not really well known and famous enough to have a full documentary about your life. But if we splice it in the right way and in the right measure, it'll be very effective. And I agree with him.
Were you surprised by the embracing of the newer, more vulnerable Gary Gulman material by your fan base? Because I know that you started in your earlier years, I've heard some of your earlier albums and seen TV spots and stuff, whereby you are talking, you're doing, what's the word, very pure observational stuff.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, stuff about Oreos, you know, it's so unique and so you, the stuff about Oreos, have you been reading my diary, you know, how do you know exactly what I want, all that kind of stuff. And it's really funny and it's really punchy. And you were presumably building up an audience who trusted you and who took pleasure in listening to your take on things. And I wonder the extent to which you... Like, was it a leap of faith for you to believe in them that they would come with you? Because from the outside, it's like, Gary, of course you can talk about real stuff. We love you.
Yeah, I think that it was so gradual, Stuart, so that I, other than the comedy studio where I was able to do almost all depression hospital material. They had so much faith in me, or just that's just his policy, and that you can talk about whatever you want, and as long as you're original and true, then he will accept that. So I had that spot, and then I gradually worked it in on the road. So I would open. I mean, it's funny because it's almost like if you were wanting to write a cliche of an observational comedian, this would be ideal. I opened with a joke about the amount of time it took to invent sweet potato fries and how these other things had been invented and anyhow, it was just pure observational, pure silly. And then I would gradually get a little bit more personal and deep over the hour. And then by the last few months of the special, it was or touring what became the special, I was able to pretty much open with what you see in the final product. And I had and this is something that I originally discovered in sports, that it's, I don't know what percentage it is of achievement and performance athletically and in entertaining, but confidence is so huge. So mm-hmm. I just had this confidence that I knew I was going to get to something funny. I knew from empirically that the audience had responded in a positive way. So the other thing that was very helpful early on was a discovery that I made and was pivotal in my recovery, was that I had been used to having my mood dictated by how the audience reacted to my last show. So I was,
yes,
I was only as good as my last show. It's like an athlete who's only as good as his last game. And mm-hmm. the bucket has a hole in it and you can never fill it because you're only as good as your last game. So I had this problem where I was, if I went up there with my new stuff that worked on Monday night, if I went up on Wednesday night and it didn't work, then it was useless. I was a failure, and my dream was something to defer and put off because I just wasn't ready. I wasn't good enough for it. And then I found in a notebook that I zoomed in on, a notebook that belonged to the problematic genius David Foster Wallace, and it was a quote from Samuel Beckett, and it was just an excerpt of the full quote, which isn't as clear of positivity, but the quote was, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail better." And that one line, "fail better," released me from any tie to my last performance being the decision or the judgment on my worth. And I just had to go up there and risk and try. And then as soon as I came across that, I started hearing every artist I respected. I remember listening to a audio book by Neil Gaiman called, I think, A View from the Cheap Seats or something like that, in which he just over and over again said, make mistakes, make big mistakes, fail. And I kept hearing that from other people about the permission to fail and taking risks and failing miserably and bombing and all these things. And that was the key, because I couldn't continue to do my comedy if every single show was a referendum on my worth as a human being. It was taking too much out of me. So again, there was just a coming together of so many different crucial the components of a recovery that came together at the right time, and so I'm really so grateful in it. And it seems sometimes that the coincidences and the timings are almost miraculous.
More from Gary coming up in just a second. As you can hear, I'm having a whale of a time talking to him, and we've got some absolute belter episodes in the can as well. Paul Sinha returns next week. After that, we have Erin Foley. Hopefully, the recording is not in the can yet, but Mr. Alistair Beckett-King will be joining us shortly. And we've got Matt Ewins, the elusive Matt Ewins, is appearing on the show, so that'll come out sometime soon as well. More from Gary shortly. Remember, comedianscomedian.com/insiders to get over 45 minutes of extras. He's so generous with his time. And he will be talking about that series of writing tips for comics that he did and why it is impossible to use up your creativity. That's one of those things I'm going to keep coming back to again and again in my own creative life. Just a little shout out, really, for everyone involved with The Infinite Sofa. Last night, as I record this, we had Maria Bamford as our guest on what became a special gala performance. We had Ewins. Ed Hedges came to talk to us about being taken hostage. We had the wonderful Stevie Martin and her book club. You can follow Stevie Martin on Twitch at Stevie Martin, but the M is... Oh, sorry, Stevie M, but the S is a 5. Yeah, so easy to remember, trips off the tongue. And do please go and not only get in touch with all of Gary's great stuff, watch The Great Depression. It's phenomenal. You can see so many of his specials on YouTube, charting the last 20 years of his career. And indeed Spotify, or you can probably buy them from him direct via his website if you'd like to actually give him some money, which I hope you will. But also, Maria Bamford was our guest last night, and her Audible original is out now on Audible. You can use some money or a credit. And remember, as it's easy to forget, your Audible credits do evaporate after time. So don't think you've got 400 racked up as I thought I had. You Are a Comedy Special is Maria Bamford's new special, and I think you are going to find it absolutely sumptuous and kind of daring and mad and wonderful and beautiful and humble and all of those kind of things. So I'm clearly replete with joy at the wonderful creativity of some non-UK comics this week. But there is loads. There's someone on Facebook whose name escapes me for the moment, apologies, who is doing the Lockdown Comedy Guide. If you've not noticed that, there's a lot of stuff still happening, even though not all of us are technically on lockdown anymore. There is a tremendous amount of stuff available online. I've spoken to you a little bit about my endeavours on Twitch, but we have now made it simpler. We have now made it simpler for you to watch The Infinite Sofa, Chops Comedy Online, which is our online comedy club that Maria is hopefully gracing us with. I'm going to try and get Gary for that as well. And also, Wednesdays in September, we're doing a thing called Think Tank, which I cannot explain given half an hour, let alone the 30 seconds or so afforded me here. But it is new, experimental, very of the moment and of the internet, and should be loads and loads of fun. All of those things are happening on my Twitch channel, but you can see them all at infinitesofa.com without having to. That's the kind of the entry point. If you're scared of the word Twitch or you think that it's just for computer games, it would be easy to think that, but there's so much more there. So go to infinitesofa.com and I should today or this week at least put a link there. I'm going to have to rejudge the comedianscomedian.com homepage to talk about all the stuff that's happening and sort of, oh God, I've got to make something incredibly complex, incredibly simple. Who knows how to do that? Probably Gary can help us out. Let's get back to the brilliant Gary Goldman.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Do you think you were protecting your earlier, your younger comedian self from those referenda on on your self-worth? I think that's beautifully put. Do you think that by doing the pure observational stuff, you were protecting yourself in some way? Did you have any sort of impetus at that time, say 20 years ago in your material, to say more and to go deeper into yourself? And actually it was a sort of a protective strategy to talk about other things, to talk about Oreos or, you know, whatever the subject is.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I definitely was trying to protect myself. And I do not think I could have, the way I was. For instance, there was a point in my career in 2007 where I was fed up with the observational stuff to a degree. I felt sort of blocked in and I didn't have an audience and that's the key, I think. I mean, I there were a few people who were there just to see me, but for the most part they were just there to see a comedy show. And so I had to juggle this. I mean, the timing was so perfect, because for the first 23 years of my career, I was trying to build an audience by getting the people who just happened to find me to come back and see me again. And so I had to win over new people and get them to come back, and experimenting. And the other thing was that it was so hard to get stage time where I was living in LA and even in New York City. And the stage time was often not great quality, in that the audiences were difficult, and they were responding more I call them party comics, the comics who get everybody riled up and ask them questions. And I mean, they do a great job at this, but they don't set them up for a comedian who wants to talk slower and wants to do things that aren't as compelling, I guess, physically. And so I think that I was protecting myself, but I also think that I wouldn't have found receptive audiences until I was able to cultivate my own audience. I think that yes, I kind of wish that I had risked more early on, and I probably would have found the right rooms and the right venues to experiment more and expand more, but also I think it may have delayed my progress, in that I wouldn't have gotten booked on the road and been able to build an audience. And had I done something that was, it's just hard to say. And I think comedy is this very strange art form where you learn in front of audiences and you get easier audiences and easier restrictions as you get better at it, and when you don't really need it as much. So it's really hard. I don't know, because so much of it was based on confidence, but also a lot of it was based on having this audience that would trust me and go with me. And I don't want to discount the aspect of it, which was at some point I wanted to do this as a job. So there was also that aspect where I was trying to also please the bookers and make them want to bring me back because I killed. That was one thing that early on I was able to get great responses from the audience and I sort of made this deal with myself. I don't have to be George Carlin or Lenny Bruce and go really deep, but I do have to be original, and I don't want to sound like other comedians, and that was sort of the deal I made, that I would be a person who could earn a living at this, but I wasn't going to be somebody who just went out there and was a claptrap audience pleaser, and so that was sort of the deal I made. But you're very perceptive to know that I had yearned for this for a long time, being able to talk about deeper things, and I feel like in another great stroke of luck and good fortune, I think now that I've covered this topic, I think people would be more willing to listen to me talk about things that are deep in maybe in another way. I don't see myself turning into Bill Hicks, because that's not really my strong suit, but I do feel comfortable talking about things that are a little more serious now, and that I feel like the audience won't be sort of sideswiped by this. Like, where did this come from? I think I've established some.
You've created a sort of safe environment,
right,
within which, or not even an environment, but like a culture of an audience. You've created a culture in your audience that's what they're looking for, and they want to be want you to continue to kind of challenge us in that way, because you've always with your language, and I know how hard you write, and we'll get onto your Dolman's writing tips, because those are just, oh my God, I hope that's going to be a book. And in fact, at the same time, if it isn't a book and it remains to just, if it remains an artifact of benevolence, that is also wonderful in its own kind of way. But just talking about your writing and when you're talking about, like, well, you know, that Bill Hicks kind of thing, that's not my strongest suit. What would you describe as your, not exactly your angle, but like, I know the sorts of things that when you do a particularly Gary Gulman phrase or stylistic phrase, you know, like over embroidering an act out, or deeply, deeply getting into the character of a very minor figure in an act out. There are certain things that I recognize, like, oh, that's absolutely you. What's your understanding of the things that you're best at?
I think I have to say that it stemmed from when I was in Los Angeles. I could get on stage if I really hustled two or three times a week. I couldn't get on stage at the Comedy Store or the Laugh Factory or the Improv, but I could do these bar shows and these shows in the side rooms of restaurants, and so I could get on stage for maybe a half hour a week. And the other time I spent when I was in Los Angeles for 6 years was I enrolled in acting programs and studied acting. So I felt like I wasn't wasting my time out there completely. But I only had about a half hour a week, and I found that it was very frustrating to work all day on a joke. You go out there, you throw out the sentence, the premise, the second sentence, it falls flat, and you're like, there's my entire week of exercise, and it's wasted on a line that I didn't even know would work. So yeah. I felt discouraged, and then I said, just how about working on jokes that already have a few lines that work and adding on to them. And that became my thing, was to go as deep on a topic as I could. And I just kept tagging and tagging and expanding, and the word didn't exist at the time, but it's so good, and I'm so angry that it became cliche. But I was really into unpacking things, so I wasn't going to let a word pass by without saying, is there something within that word? Because I'm not going up on these stages that even though they weren't great stages, you still had to sort of qualify to be brought back there. So you had to do well. I couldn't just go up there and screw around, because the very few stages that I was allowed to work out at were going to shrink if I bombed time after time. And also, I don't know if this was just exaggerated or was a fact, there seemed to always be somebody in the audience who was in some way helpful in getting you more work or auditions or things like that. So it wasn't, you couldn't just screw around every night. So that became sort of my thing. I was going to go further. You could have a joke about something, and I would say, that's great. You talk about it for five sentences. I will talk about it for 50. And then it became, I don't want to even talk about things that somebody has a couple of sentences on, because I found that was another way to distinguish myself from the other comedians that yes. I noticed that so many people were talking about the same things, and as much as I recognize great relationship material, I knew that I wasn't going to stand out by writing relationship material. And as much as I admire the guys who can be really adult and dirty and things like that, I love that kind of humor. I knew that I didn't have the experience in life with crazy experiences and bizarre relationships that I could top them. I just, how far can I go? My life has been pretty normal, and my attitudes are pretty mainstream. So it was difficult for me to really stretch the limits in that area. The one area that I found I could stretch the limits was just I guess originality, and also the depth which I would sort of analyze and to take apart different topics that I didn't find a lot of other comedians were doing. And the other thing was that I found that I often had just naturally an opinion on something that was the opposite of mainstream comedians. So I found that a lot of comedians hated certain things, and I would say I actually love them, I appreciate them. I want to talk in a positive manner about them. It was very, when I was coming up in the 90s, it was so cynical. Every take was bashing, every opinion was negative, and I found just by going with my own natural take on things, I was able to have I wouldn't call it radical, but an unusual take.
Yes. Well, just to come back to the language for a second.
Sure.
When you're so good at pitching for a word which is not so unusual that we don't know it, but I'm thinking, of course, in like in your good example would be in the States, the abbreviating the States bit, which is one of your most well known bits. So obviously, ne'er do wells.
Yes.
How often do well?
Right.
Ne'er. Like yes. We've heard that. Know what? It's like a little Gary Larson cartoon. It's like we all know that. We just haven't done the work.
Yeah.
You know, it's such a beautiful example of it. And then I don't know if it actually I don't know which version of it. I've certainly heard a version, I think, on an album, which is what? Air? Nah. I don't think that even makes it into the Conan set because it's almost like I look at it now and made some notes on the Conan thing. Dottie was a pistol. She was a real hot ticket. How Dottie is this? You know, and then sort of something going on to explain something that she'd said. The sentences are like four or five words long, and every one of them is its own little micro universe of color and flavor and something really unexpected and detail about the character.
Yeah, I think the key is unexpected. So I remember when I was living in Los Angeles, every day I would have, I mean, it wasn't coffee. We would sit at the Starbucks on Melrose for 3 to 12 hours. And we would, this friend of mine, his name is Rick Harris. And he is one of the great comedic minds who, for whatever reason, stopped doing it in his 30s and became an English teacher. And we would just discuss comedy for hours. We would bounce jokes off each other. And I was always in awe of him. And he said, what people love is hearing words they forgot they knew. And, yeah. And I said, oh my gosh, that is so true. And so the unexpected is like you definitely don't want the audience to be ahead of you. So if yet sometimes the audiences will still laugh even though they either have seen the joke before or you would have to be a fool not to know the punchline. Anyhow, I didn't want to do that. I wanted the audience to hear the last word or last reference that they were expecting. So I go out of my way and pretty much before I try it out, I have a pretty good inkling of what the audience will respond to. Sometimes I'm wrong, but at this point I kind of, just because I know that I have a similar sense of humor to the people I'm entertaining. And so I know that ne'er-do-well is a word we come across enough. And it's the other thing is that it's not said that much in comedy. I think too many comedians don't trust the audience enough to use their vocabulary. And I have this sort of, and maybe it's foolish, but I have this idea that if I know a word, then you should know it. And if you don't, I'm a little bit surprised because I'm not the person who got a remarkable verbal score on my SATs. I'm not a person who is just, I don't have a master's or anything like that. I really believe that I'm never using words that you wouldn't come across in the newspaper or in magazine articles. I really believe and I think the audience appreciates those words and there's something to, and I didn't invent this, but there's something to talking about mundane things in more intellectual way that I think people find really entertaining. And I also think that a lot of people are like me. We like to hear people talk in a smart way. I think it's why shows like the West Wing and I'm trying to think of the other show by Aaron Sorkin, Sports Night, why they were so popular, because it's I don't know if it's soothing, but it's very entertaining to listen to smart people talk. And so I think that that's another reason why I love the audio books, is because you're listening to a smart person talk and you're picking up words and adding them to your inventory, and a word will pop up and you'll think to yourself, that's the word that goes into that joke that will, yes, that will make it better. It has the right assonance because you're hearing it said out loud by another person. It has the right rhythm, the right number of syllables, and it's just obscure enough that people aren't going to expect you to say it. And that's what we keep striving for in our work is surprising the people with the punchline and also along the way to the punchline. I think too many comedians sit out the setup and because we've been told that the setup needs to be short and the setup needs to just get you along. But there's so much that can be done in the setup and people are, if you have the right audience, people will join you on the what are the, why can't I think of the digressions?
Well, something else you're really very, very adept at is that type of joke where you let them get ahead of you. In a, like, I'm thinking of the this. I don't know which album it was from, but the bit about people being barely billionaires.
Oh yeah,
they, you know, people who are almost billionaires. They round it up. They know their failures. But you said that would be the equivalent of winning the jackpot every week for 6 weeks, and then you say, "I'm going to warn you." That type of streak, and it's like the dot, 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 the ellipsis at the end of that just lets everyone catch up with the thought.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I just think you're particularly good at doing that. And I think that's it's from the same family as what we're talking about now, which is that it's not patronizing the audience, allowing them to have their own intelligence and giving them enough of the crossword clue of the joke.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
they can fill it in themselves and then they manifest their own timing.
Yeah, I think our friend Alex Edelman, we call him Edelman. I think the Brits call him Edelman. He talked about, is it, maybe he referred to it as negative space or something. The Simpsons do it.
That sounds very Edelman.
Yeah, where you let the audience fill in the punchline or whatever. And it's sort of like my all-time favorite joke, if I had to save one joke so that people could recreate humor, I love this joke. It's just a line where the person says to another person, when somebody tells you something tragic happened, if you say, "Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play?" I just that makes me laugh every time because I think it's kind of subversive in that this woman who has had her beloved husband and historical figure murdered in front of her, you're asking her whether she enjoyed the play. I think it's just there's so much going on there that isn't said and you're not even telling the person who Lincoln is. It's just Lincoln is just the perfect name and and he was at a play. It has everything.
So the end of that routine, or maybe it's towards the end of that routine about billionaires,
uh-huh,
is you talk about how they have to be insane. And you say they have to be insane,
yes,
dot, 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 in order for me to cope with their success. And I've written in capital letters, brilliant. Because what you like, it's such a lovely, daffy exploration of an idea that then is beautifully drawn to a very human point. You know, you're talking about, you're perfectly nailing the kind of the insanity of competitive richness. And then like revealing that, you know, it isn't a magnanimous opinion, like you have a stake in it, which is that you can't cope with how well they're doing. And it's just such a perfect routine. Do you write on stage? And do you ever stumble upon a ne'er do well, how often do well, ne'er? Do you ever stumble upon that on stage, or is that always kind of ground out on the page?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because I always try to get to this when I talk about process. So when I was living in Los Angeles, stage time was at such a premium that I had to write down, memorize, say out loud, prepare every sentence I was saying on stage. Occasionally I would have some confidence to to riff. There was one particular place called the Cafe Nervosa, maybe, or no, I think that's from Frasier. There was a show. It was called Psychobabble, and it was at a cafe that had a clever name and not one that you rolled your eyes at or groaned, but it was called Psychobabble and the show. And I would go on there, and the woman really liked me and let me do a lot of time and was very nurturing as far as I could talk about whatever I wanted to. And I was convinced that nobody from the industry would be there until a casting agent approached me after one show and brought me in. But anyhow, it was a place that I felt safe. And so, but other than that, I was writing down, memorizing, performing. And at about 2006, I moved to New York. The same thing happened. Every spot was gold. I had to prepare everything. And then in around 2010 or 11, I started to get some road work where I would do hours on the road. And I was able to give myself some leeway as far as write it down, memorize it, then if it's going well, see if this line works. And that line works, well, you just earned another line because they're still laughing. Try that line. And I would just keep going until they stopped laughing. It was sort of a training wheels approach to writing on stage. And then as that worked and I started to build an audience and I was also able to get stage time more readily, and the stage time wasn't dependent on me killing, which was pretty much every place. But the Comedy Cellar is still a place where I feel like I need to be prepared, because you're going on after comedians who are just annihilating. You're going on after Dave Attell, and you're going on after guys like Ted Alexandro and Big J Okerson and Colin Quinn and Hasan Minhaj and Mike Birbiglia, and you're going on after these guys who killed, and you won't even really get a good test of your comedy if you're not doing your best on those shows, because the audience has just raised their expectations. So anyhow, I got to a place where I can now write on stage and record, listen to those recordings and the things that I riffed. And usually I remember it pretty well, but there are certain nights, and you know this, where you're like, I need to get exactly how I said it, because I've said it 30 different ways and only this way worked. And I need to write that down and memorize it. So it's sort of it used to be I would write, memorize, record, get it all down. And then I found that it was helpful to listen, because then I would say, well, I could have said more there. What else could I have said there? And now it's compounding that, because I'm on stage and riffing and then getting that extra bite at the apple where I'm sitting down listening to it. And I said, oh, I could have even gone further there. And I ran out of time here. I could have added this. And I think that at every point, the key was to just try and think with a pen in my hand and add things and adjust things and find a better word so that you're using placeholders. And one thing I've found so helpful in the past couple of years is to when I write, to write a word either in all capital letters if I'm typing, or if I write in my book, I'll put a big square around it, and that means that I need to go back with my brain and maybe a thesaurus and find a better word better word for that, because that's not the right word. It's the Mark Twain has this great quote, and I've heard it a number of different ways. The best way I heard it was the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and a lightning bug. So I found that really, really helpful to go back and replace the placeholders. But the thing is, with most comedians, and we know them, they're so distracted, and I hate to use the word lazy, but it's lazy to know that there's a word out there that needs to be replaced, and you haven't even addressed it. I'll see comedians over the years with the same sore thumb sticking out in their act that they just won't replace, the jokes that never get a laugh, and they won't make an adjustment, and I find myself saying to myself, I would never say this to a person, but I say, why do I want them to be a better comedian than they want to be?
Yeah, I saw on your Instagram feed there was a screen grab of like a dictionary, internet online dictionary, saying meretricious, and then a definition of meretricious, and you titled it "There's always the word." There's always a word. And yeah. I think that's, is that a series? I wonder if I saw you somewhere else on your feed.
It's not a series, because I can't find one every day. But whenever I come up with one, I put it in there, and in so many cases, it's just a discovery or a rediscovery of a word that just says so much in one word. It's remarkable.
There was a moment in The Great Depression where I paused the screen in order to kind of enhance and zero in on what was written in your notebook, which was laid open on a table. And what was written in your notebook was capital letters, "Just talk about it." And I've written similar notes to myself. I write things like, just say what you think. Just say what you mean.
Yeah. Just say it. Yeah. Yeah. That was so helpful. But again, I needed to have a place that allowed me to just talk about it, because I've had experiences after The Great Depression at the Comedy Cellar where I tried that and got sidetracked by an audience member who ridiculed me out loud and demanded funny. And I was so taken aback that I basically interviewed this person, and people started walking out, and the manager of the club told me that you can't do that. There's an obligation to entertain here, and I understood, but at the same time, it was jarring, because I'd had this experience at the Comedy Studio and a lot of other places in New York that aren't as high profile as the Comedy Cellar, where I can do whatever I want and I'll be invited back. They were not saying you won't be invited back. I want to be clear about that. They were just saying that's not something that you can do every night. And I mean, it was helpful in some ways, but it was also a little bit disappointing, but also it keeps you disciplined in that just talk about it and be funny are equally valid things to write down. But at that time, when I was working on my Great Depression, it was really, really crucial to examine every angle. And I wonder if you ever find this in your writing, and I wanted to make sure to discuss this as far as the process. I don't know if I put this into the tips, but one thing that kept me from being discouraged over the past 20 years was, when I would first start out, I would have this idea for a great joke, and I would fill 25 notebook pages with it, and I would try to memorize it, and then I would go on stage and the half of the sentences I hadn't memorized, the ones that I did memorize didn't work, and I felt like I had wasted an entire day on this thing. And so my new policy after about 6 years of comedy was that I was going to on a brand new joke that I had never tried before, I was going to give it a page or two, and if that worked, then I would write the 25 pages or whatever. I'm probably exaggerating, but then I would.
Yes.
Although all told, a lot of these jokes have hundreds of pages, but it was a better use and a more efficient use of my time to build on things that worked rather than try to reinvent the wheel. And so I know that sometimes I won't even bother to write down things because I'll say, well, if the first sentence doesn't work, then the fourth sentence isn't going to work. So what's the point? But then I remember it because I wasn't even trying to remember it on stage if the first one works, and I'm just, and then I find myself a lot of times, and this is indulgent, but I'll say, now audience, what if I say it with this word at the end? Do you like it any better with this word?
I do last, things like that all the time.
Last word in the sentence. And isn't that so fun for us? I don't know if it's fun for the audience, but it's so helpful to have the greatest art form, because you get that instant feedback on maybe not whether it's good art, but whether it works and we know there gets to a point where it doesn't have to. And I think you're at this point as well, where, yeah, I'm going to get laughs on what I say. That's just the bare bottom I can do. But I also want the comedians who are there to appreciate it and not always laugh, but say that's a good joke. And that I haven't heard that take. So we're at a point now where we're not there to make the other comedians laugh. But if the other comedians think it's shit, then it's not worth holding on to. That we're at a point now where I think it's almost even a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you think to yourself, well, I can't do any better than that, I can't write anymore, then you won't. But that the idea of I always say to myself, I'll figure it out. I'll figure it out. But it's not a natural confidence. It's just that I've done it 100 times. And also, there's this thing that we don't take into account because you can't quantify it. You can't capture it. You can't. Some people say you can sort of engage it or turn it on. But there's this component that I feel only comes out through time. It's almost, I mean, and I never know what time. I just know that I'm working on a I have a book contract, and so I'm writing this book, and I was writing for about an hour last night, and I was like, this sucks, and just repeat that for 60 minutes, and then a sentence where I said, oh my gosh, that is terrific. That is, I've been digging for 60 minutes and I've got a sentence of 5 words, and it's a good thing I didn't quit at 59 minutes and 53 seconds, because it was, and sometimes it's 2 hours, sometimes it's 15 minutes, but whatever it is. And the thing I'm talking about obviously is the unconscious or the subconscious, the part that is, that they say is doing work when we're not even thinking, but there's so much, especially in that abbreviating the states joke, where I say, well, I can't explain where that came from. It was just the one night I said, I mean, the whole premise of that joke is that it's a documentary, but it's not a documentary. But I never said it was a documentary until I had had the joke in my notebook and knocked off the rust every several months when I had a really good crowd, tried it out, it would bomb, back into my act. And then one night I had a joke about the Helvetica documentary, and on a whim, the audience was so good, I said, why don't we bring out this absurd abbreviating the States joke, and we'll say it's a documentary. It was not that deliberate. It was subconscious. It was
yes.
And until it wasn't. And so I've heard, I think it was John Cleese was working with a friend of mine at the Montreal Comedy Festival. They were writing together, and he said, it comes out in 2 hours. You need to write for 2 hours before it starts coming out. And I just thought that was possible. And he also said that if you wrote the same time every day, you could engage it quicker if your mind knew that it was going to that place. But I mean, I'm sure there are books and books written on the idea and how to bring it out. But I only know that if I am ruminating on my jokes with either in the shower or on long walks or long runs, that a lot of work is being done for me.
What is it that you love about Vonnegut? We'll wrap up shortly. You've given me so much of your time. Before we do, I am a huge fan of Vonnegut. I have the there's a quote. I don't know if it's in one of your tips or in something else that I read. The quote, if this isn't nice, I don't know what is. I have that set on my Google Home, so it says it to me every morning when I ask it to turn the radio on in the morning, like 6:30. I'm up with my babies, and the Google robot says, "If this isn't nice, I don't know what is." It's so meaningful to me to repeat that and to say it and to kind of make it a mantra.
Yeah,
and so many, you know, the thing that you, I think you quoted in like a big chunk of Vonnegut from one of his forward. I don't remember to which.
Yes.
Book, but it's about the parallel between war and the arts.
Yes.
Anyone who survives a human wave attack against such daunting odds does do because of dumb luck. Agility, courage, and character have nothing to do with how it all turns out. Gifted artists have to be what they are, have to do what they do the way they do it. And whether they earn a living and fame thereby is a matter of happening by chance upon breaks in the barbed wire unswept by machine gun fire. Oh my God.
I've got the chills. Yeah. I really do. And I've heard it. I've read it 100 times it's just, I mean, it's that type of humane kindness and thoughtfulness and resistance to the machismo and masculinity and pride and just that is in every bit of his writing. Just I have this wall. I don't know what you would call it, but it's grooved letters in a sign that says, "Hello, babies. Welcome to Earth. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. It's round and wet and crowded. On the outside, babies, you've got 100 years here. There's only one rule I know of, babies. God damn it, you've got to be kind." And that's one of my favorite quotes. And then the other one on my wall here is, "We are what we pretend to be, so we must be careful about what we pretend to be," which is just, I think, so helpful to comedians who say, "I'm just being a character, and these horrible things I'm saying have no weight and no matter because it's just a character." But I think if words have meaning, then you have to be careful with them. So I think it's Kurt Vonnegut's, I mean, his humanity, but also he's funny. He can be vulgar. He's just so human. And also his imagination is incredible. And he has this great, I don't know if it was an intentional device, but where he sort of puts out these wild sci-fi premises in that last maybe a sentence or a paragraph, and they're credited to his alter ego Kilgore Trout. So that there's this wonderful aspect where he gets to play within his books, and then just his philosophy. I think I could learn everything I needed to behave in an ethical, humane, moral way by exclusively reading his books, nonfiction and fiction. And I read other authors. I love Philip Roth and Steinbeck and other authors. I'm trying to think of who else I have the most books of. Probably Vonnegut and Philip Roth. I have the most books on hand, but and then Toni Morrison. But I and Toni Morrison is a similar writer in that I she's so humane and kind, I think, in her writing, and I just am so moved by people like that, because there's so much cynicism within that world, and Vonnegut, I guess you could say he was a pessimist, and that he was always talking about the end of the world and we're at end times. But I also think he really believed in the kindness or at least the value of kindness, and so that I just have been moved by him since the first book I read of his, which was the Slaughterhouse Five, which isn't even my favorite book. I think my favorite is The Sirens of Titan, but it was I think of him as sort of a secular saint.
Ah, oh, that's lovely. Is that your own, the secular saint?
No, it couldn't be. It couldn't be. I'm sure somebody else has said that. Anytime you have two words and their alliteration and they kind of go together well, somebody has made that connection before. I find it so funny when you think that you've coined a phrase, you type it into Google, and there's a t-shirt and a website.
So that was Gary. Really, really joyful to talk to him. We got cut off at the end there, but I'm going to trust your editor, Nathan, to have put a beautiful bow on that. I often get to a point with interviews where I go, oh, that'll be an end point, but let's see if we can squeeze something else out. So I'm sure we had one of those this time. Remember, 45 minutes of brilliant extra content available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders, or if you are already a member, and remember, you can join with a minimum donation of £2 a month or as much as you want, but everyone gets the same stuff because your financial worth is not a reflection of your self-worth. All right, let's keep hammering the principles. Gary will talk about his extensive writing tips for comics and why it's impossible to use up creativity. And do you remember when I did Conan, Clang? Do you remember I talked about the thing that JP, the booker and kind of a co-architect of my set there, the thing that he said to me before I went on stage? We find out Gary's one as well. It's great. So comedianscomedian.com/insiders, or if you're already a member, it'll be in your private feed now. I mean, it'll be there right now. And I guarantee that, because I know that Nathan will listen to this whilst editing it and realise that I have made a guarantee on his behalf. Sorry, Nathan. Catch up with Gary at Gary Gulman on social media or garygulman.com, and you can find out everything I'm up to at comedianscomedian.com, which will shortly link you to infinitesofa.com. Dave Gorman is my guest on the Infinite Sofa next Monday at 9, if you are listening to this in real time. If not, you can catch that episode probably on YouTube. Go to youtube.com/comcompod. See what I mean? Too many things now. I need a website which is just a my grinning face and lots of little circles where you can do whatever you need. But the problem is, to describe what's in the circles would need more than an icon and more words than you could fit in one of the little circles, the size of which I'm imagining now. Follow us, by which I mean me, at ComComPod. You can follow my own Twitter, at Stu Goldsmith. I post a joke there approximately once every 3 months. It's been easy to not write any actual jokes whilst producing all of these different projects and machines and things. But I did do some recently. I wrote a new bit. And if you're feeling down, why not write a new bit? Because just coming up, like, I mean, obviously it was the one good bit out of 30 shit new bits. But the one good bit, which I think, well, it's got potential. When the world comes back, that'll work. That'll grow. Enormous positives for my mental health. Speaking of which, I'll give you an update on the old budget therapy in the postamble. But for now, this concludes the show. Paul Sinner returns next week. You're going to love it. Bye for now.
So just a little update then. Lots going on at the moment. My son, the Boutros, started school yesterday and came back and said it was awesome. So I'm thrilled with that because, as you may recall, depending on your connection to my own life story, I did not find school wonderful. Primary school, I can't remember. I'm sure it was bliss. But the word school, and more specifically, the fabric, the grey fabric of a school trouser, which I have not touched since I wore my own at age 16 for the last time, and brought back some weird kind of, what's the word, psychokinetic memories, some sort of psycho, not psychogeographical, not a place, but a thing, like a psychoarchitectural. Sure, I mean, that sounds feasible. I basically, we were getting stuff ready for school, and I was like, oh, school trousers, and I kind of picked them up and had one of those camera in, like zoom in, pan out, or what is it? Focus in, zoom out moments, such as the critic has at the end of the film Ratatouille. And every time I talk about school, I get a little bit shaky. That's actually a genuine frog in my throat now, not an emotional thing. But, excuse me. So not that I was worried, but I'm aware that it's a jungle out there. And he seemed to have a wonderful time romping through it. So that's great. And I mean, listen, I'm sorry if you dip in and out of this podcast and you remember my elation at the Boutros' birth some 4.5 years ago. And I'm like, what, he's at school? Yeah, that's it. That's my thing about children. That's my view on children is very much like it is like firing an anchor or a grappling hook into time itself. And then you spend the rest of your life paying the rope out going, gosh, I know exactly how many years it's been since that big event now, because there's a number on it worn proudly by my child. That was good. Little therapy update. Thank you. Some of you sent me very kind messages about the fact I was getting back into therapy. I tried somebody and it was quite a fun experience because in order to get some privacy, I had to Zoom call them from my van parked outside the house using the Wi-Fi, war driving my own Wi-Fi. It became apparent in the first few moments that he lived a 30-second walk away. So, I mean, I thought to myself, look, I've booked the time off and I've paid for this in advance, and it was only a sort of half-price trisee session anyway. I thought, let's see if we get anything out of it. We're both, you know, we've booked the time off, both of us. But I was fairly sure that it would need to have gone electrifyingly well for me to be comfortable with the idea of a therapist who lived, I'm not 30, call it a minute and a half. I mean, it's a small area where I live, and I'm pretty sure I didn't, but I'm pretty sure I could have guessed the house from the decor on the inside, because there's a couple of houses around here that have a certain style. And I thought, maybe it's, I almost meant, mate, do you live next to XYZ? But I didn't, because I thought, let's go the thing. And it was useful. It was useful to start reconsidering all of that stuff. It wasn't the right fit in the end. And I think, I mean, it would have needed to be astonishingly appropriate right off the blocks for me to go, cool, so when I need therapy, I'll just pop round your house. And I tell you what, it was COVID notwithstanding. The part of me that used to have an opening joke about the fact I wore Merrill's approach shoes all the time, the part of me that cannot countenance a pair of trousers or a pair of shoes if they don't let me run for a bus in all weathers in them. That little efficiency-driven part of me, which I love and hate, was very excited about the idea of going, oh, I'm having a bit of a wobble. I'll see if therapist X is available. And literally, I could be in his office 5 minutes later on foot. I mean, that was very exciting. But it was not to be. I'm going to keep looking. And I suppose my preoccupation at the moment is that I like that I like that aspect of my life, which is self-made. And whether you are employed or self-employed or freelance in some capacity, or whether you are, you know, somewhere on the spectrum of all sorts, the nature of your employment, the nature of your creativity, of how you see the world, of how you, you know, I've got friends, I've got some of my old recreational friends from back in the day. They're forever showing me, oh, look, I've got a new, this is my Monzo card. And you go, oh, there's a whole new way to do banking. This isn't a sponsored ad. I'm just trying to draw a parallel. No matter who you think you know, no matter how well you know the people you know, everyone is building their own life and goes, oh, look, I could do this. I could. No, we've gotten rid of the car, actually. We just use a skateboard. I don't know what I'm talking about. Come on, focus. My point is, God, I've just, in saying focus, I've remembered the wonderful moment at the Christchurch World Buskers Festival as was many years ago, where David Quirk, brilliant comic, go back and re-listen to his episode, what a wonderful comic. David Quirk, who's a very loose comic, and on stage was being so loose that someone heckled him by just shouting, "Focus!" It was absolutely wonderful. My point is, this is me. That was me attempting to focus. That was a focus-based anecdote. The point is, everyone builds their life, and the nature with which I am building my life at the moment, particularly in the pandemic, where I'm looking at my live gig offers and thinking, is that what I do now? If I'm not up and running doing 5 gigs a week, it seems mad to just go to Nottingham once, you know, once in the week. Until it all comes back, why not live a different life? There's a bit of that in it. I'm not made my mind up on that. Please still offer me gigs. But between all of the different internet stuff, the great list of projects and Twitch and podcasts and the child labour podcast I'm doing with Sindhu, that's been extraordinary. It's been so much fun and is continuing to be. There's so much going on. And in the way that I look at my email inbox, I've got sort of 3 inboxes now, and 2 of them are to-do lists and one of them I just don't look at. And the social media, the steps we're all having to take to safeguard our mental health and to safeguard our ability to get anything done due to the multiplicity of apps and software and platforms in our life, all of which are designed in a lab by scientists to completely suck and enfold our attention. Like, how could you, for a living, work across 2 platforms, both of which are constantly, like, say, Facebook and Twitter, both of which are constantly procedurally trying to interest you and make you stay on them? Part of me thinks, do I need a therapist? Do I need a life coach? Do I need an ADHD diagnosis? About which I'm only being mildly flippant. There's a lot of red flags, but still no official stuff on that. Do I need a... Do you know what I mean? What do I need? What is the job that I need? I think I need a genie. I need such a finely tailored expert in me and the world that I've built for myself. We're getting to a point. That's almost the point, isn't it? And I'm not saying I'm special in this regard. We are all like this to a greater or lesser extent. What is it that I need? I need a sort of tailored expert who can come in and say, I have knowledge of anxiety, ADHD, depression, sometimes, getting things done, the internet, I'm across all the platforms, I know all about podcasts, I know all about Twitch, I know all about streaming, such that I, your saviour, can say, you need to do more of this and less of this and stop doing that entirely. But that job doesn't exist. That job doesn't exist. It probably will, and it will probably be... How frightening is the idea? Not frightening. How futuristic is the idea of doing online therapy to an app? Have you seen these adverts? Maybe they don't pop up on your feed like they do with mine. Strange, isn't it? Maybe there will be that. Maybe that job will exist in the future and it will be automated. That's all I've got for you. If you know of anyone who does exquisitely tailored, don't get excited about the ADHD thing. It's almost certainly not the case. Maybe it's just a completely standard reaction to the multiplicity of all of the things clamouring for one's attention these days, to feel that you can't keep a thought in your head. There we go. That was... Previously, the end was the bit where we tied a nice bow on that, and then I kept talking. Bye for now. Paul Sinner returns next week. A pleasure talking to you. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com. Get in touch on social media @comcompod. But do it in a specific and worthwhile way that will reward me for engaging with it, rather than simply, that's too much. You can't say that. Goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.